This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblé.
And I'm Yannick Marien.
And what's our topic for this week?
The life and death of iconoclasm.
Ooh, interesting. And obviously, before we start, we do have follow-up.
Yay!
So, regarding last episode, something funny happened. I had Skype issues. Also, it was the first time either Yannick or I did a French cameo. I really enjoyed that, by the way.
Yeah, I snuck that in at the end of the editing. I should point out that today I have been cursed with absolutely terrible connectivity at work and here. So I hope we won't have Skype issues today, but I've been having really terrible internet today, no matter where I am. So that's no fun.
Maybe you're the cause of the bad internet.
Yeah, maybe I'm radiating some weird waves.
Oh my goodness. Good. So now on to the real follow-up. So MacRumor was reporting that Ford is bringing Siri Eyes Free to 5 million vehicles, including mine. Yay! Oh my goodness, I was so happy this week. So Ford announced that their latest Sync, My Ford Touch Sync version 3.8 will also include Siri Eyes Free. So you'll be able to use the talk to sync button and change that feature to talk to Siri. So hopefully I'll be able to do that upgrade during Christmas time, but I was able to confirm via my Ford owner's portal that my new car will be upgradable to that latest version. So I was pretty happy about that. Obviously, Ford still kept its silence regarding CarPlay, and because people were asking for it. And I'm guessing that CarPlay, if it comes into an update, will be only available to their new Sync 3 system, which this update is for the second generation of it. Also, last week was the week of let's upgrade all of our devices, especially Apple devices. Apple released iOS 9.2, watchOS 2.1, tvOS 9.1, and macOS 10.11.2. So we got tons of updates, but I think the most important one were related to the tvOS. The 9.1 update brings remote app support back into the Apple TV. Yay! And also, it brings Siri integration for the Apple Music app, which people were complaining about, but I don't care that much. Regarding the rest, I think most of for the other platforms are bug fixes, and hopefully people were mentioning that especially 9.2 brings tons of feature enhancement and bug fixes.
I hope that battery life is a little better on 9.2 because my friends and I have been experiencing terrible, terrible battery life on iOS 9 recently, where we get to 20% really fast and then at 20% we'll drop off by like 12% in like one hit. And it's not just me. I thought I was going crazy and there was maybe something bad with my phone, but other friends of mine have confirmed this on their own phones. So I am hoping that once I can upgrade to 9.2, which shouldn't be too soon, as we'll discuss in a little bit, I'm looking forward to seeing if that fixes my battery woes.
And it's happening on your iPhone and iPad, or only on your iPhone?
Well, it's harder to notice on the iPad because you don't use it in, like, big chunks.
Yeah, sure.
So I don't know if it's happening on the iPad, but I'm not noticing it as much on the iPad. Whereas on the iPhone, it's really clear. Like I will be like at 30% on my phone. And then maybe like 5 seconds later, I'll get a message and it'll say, oh, you have 14% battery left. And I just got the dialogue to say like, do you want to enter low battery mode or whatever? And it's really, really strange. And low power mode doesn't appear to have any impact on whether or not my battery is staying full or not. It's just, I've been having terrible battery life for the last month and a half, 2 months, and I can't point exactly what's wrong with it. I tried disabling background downloads on every single app that I have, hoping that I would find the culprit, and nothing has fixed my situation. So I think it's an OS problem, but I just can't do anything about it right now until I can upgrade to 9.2 and hopefully it'll be fixed.
Yeah, hopefully for you, 9.2 will fix it, or you'll end up just restoring your phone and do a fresh backup. And if it doesn't fix it, time to go to the Apple Store. Yay!
Well, my warranty period is over because I don't take the Apple Care because I upgrade every 2 years anyway, so.
Time to buy a new iPhone. Yay!
Maybe when the new iPhones come out next year.
Lastly, I think we're starting to be a real podcast now because last episode I talked about Swift and you did chime in a bit. And the next day after recording, Apple announced that Swift was open source. Not announced, but they released the open source project for Swift.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that happened like the day after we recorded last time.
It did happen the day after we recorded.
Yeah, that was actually really funny.
So last week, Apple published and put online swift.org, which is the website for the Swift projects. Also open source all of the Swift code base, including all of its Git history since the beginning in 2010 on GitHub. And what I really enjoy about this, the way they did the open source is, first of all, they're all pretty open about it. They just didn't decide to just put a zip file somewhere. And we do have access to the full history. And also we do have a roadmap, which I really like. You know what? It was really strange, like, especially after the episode and then reading all of the news regarding to the open sourcing of Swift the next day and the roadmap and knowing that Swift 3.0 is in about a year with tons of great feature. It kind of re-energized myself regarding Swift in a really, really strong way. And I'm pretty happy about that. So hopefully I'll stay on that, big vibe. And we'll see, and I'll be able to include Swift more often in my projects.
Yeah, we should mention that John Gruber's The Talk Show this week has a phenomenal episode with John Siracusa, and more importantly, special guest Craig Federighi, who decides to talk about Swift quite a bit during the episode. They do get a little bit geeky sometimes. I do wish the interview had been a little bit geekier and maybe pressed on a little bit more things, but I note that John is careful not to ask any questions that he thinks won't get answered. And in certain cases, I think that's not necessarily always the greatest idea because you can push on certain things. But yeah, it's a really good episode for finding out like where they're coming from for this. And yeah, sure, there's the usual Apple marketing stuff you expect in there. But it's also fairly interesting to see them go into the community podcast and basically discuss it there and not just stick to PR channels.
Yeah, especially when Federighi started to geek out a little bit about his own experience with Objective-C and then his kind of, not learning curve, but all of this learning process in his own team and is one of his own team regarding the Swift language and all of that stuff, and especially in other teams that he needs to manage regarding on their own learning process with Swift. So this maybe like 35 minutes at the beginning of this week episode is pretty interesting. I cannot comment on the rest of the podcast because I'm currently maybe like an hour in. So, and including this interview with Craig Federighi, this episode is 3 hours and 20 minutes long. So I'll have a big catch up to do in the coming days.
Everyone who thinks that our podcast is too long, too bad. Our podcast is short by modern standards.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think we can consider the like 2 hour episode, maybe like a medium sized podcast episode.
It's basically like the episodes when Marco comes on and they have to split it into two parts and then they're both 2 hours long. Well, that's what we did. We did one parter for the Apple Watch and it was about as long as one of the two parts for those Marco episodes.
Yep. And before we start on your topic, I heard that you have something to talk related to maybe something new in your life.
Yeah, we're starting a new segment in the follow-up here on Limitless Possibility. It's called Tales from the Enterprise.
Tales from the Enterprise. Enterprise. Enterprise.
Yeah, so basically, if you haven't seen on Twitter, I got the job that I was talking about on the last episode. And I am now working at an insurance company on a project I cannot talk about publicly until maybe the month of April or May. So that is nice. But I would like to say that it's going incredibly well in a new job. I am incredibly lucky to be with coworkers that I already knew. So I knew that I would get along with them. And also someone that we both of us have heard about through high school, and I haven't told you who that is yet, so maybe I should tell you later.
Oh, suspense. I like that.
Yeah. I really like my coworkers. I am having a lot of fun right now because it is very different from Objective-C and Swift development for iOS, and I really needed to take a break from that because I was incredibly burnt out after doing it for basically 6 years. It's really refreshing. I would like to point out, on these segments, basically things that I appreciate from my new work environment or development tools, that I didn't really enjoy in my previous life as an iOS developer. And this week's thing is going to be dealing with XML. Have you used the Foundation XML APIs?
A little bit, to be honest. Like, I knew which keys to look in an XML file, so I did use
NSXML parser, I believe.
Yeah, but I think I'm confusing it with Document, which is Mac only, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, there's some kind of weird distinction like
that.
So
I think I only use the parser one, the one on iOS.
The one on iOS, right. Basically, if you're developing on iOS and you want to deal with XML, you are either going to kill yourself or use a third-party library. I have some experience in one of the Mitsuba updates that I was working on, Mitsuba 2.0, which never shipped. I had basically this Objective-C wrapper that I made for XML where I could use CSS selectors to get XML. Basically, I would take an HTML document in there and I would use CSS selectors to get exactly to the part of the page that I wanted to scrape from, which would have been really nice. And I hated using NSXML parser so bad, especially since NSXML parser, not that good for HTML, which is not XHTML, which is a whole other thing. So I dropped down to libxml2 directly in C. I would rather do that than use what we had in Objective-C. And funnily enough, back in like 2006, 2007, I was learning C# against the Mono runtime on OS X. And one of the things I loved back then was XML document in .NET, which is incredibly well made. If you wanted to make an API to deal with XML, you would make XML document probably. You would either come up with XML document in C#, or you would come up with Nokogiri on Ruby, which is probably my favorite way of dealing with XML, really. But XML document is a really good attempt from basically a big company, and Nokogiri is more for the hacker mentality kind of stuff. I had to write a tool because there are resource files in .NET, which are .resx files, and effectively they are just XML that get compiled into class files at compile time. And we're using that for translation in our app. And I needed to make some, basically, a tool that would take the French translation and create an English translation file from it, but leave the French translation in the comment so that I could also see what the original string was, because the key is not necessarily the original string. And I wrote that thing with XML document, and it was really not painful and a ton of fun. And I love XML document in .NET. Please steal this API in Swift. If you're listening, Apple, it would be really useful to your developers because NSXML parser is garbage. And that's it for Tales from the Enterprise this week, I guess.
Wow. I'm surprised that you decided to speak about XML and said that you like to use it in a certain case.
Well,
/ context.
XML itself is sort of a required evil when dealing with .NET stuff because all of it is basically XML when it boils down to it, aside from the source files. So when you're developing internal tools that deal with the .NET frameworks, you basically have to delve into XML. Sure, it would be nice if it was JSON or YAML or some other more human-readable format, but if I'm dealing with XML with XML document, it's not completely terrible. There's still weird shit like namespace URLs that you're not quite sure why people even care about that, because that's not what you care about when you're trying to deal with an XML file, that it validates with a certain namespace necessarily. But if you ignore that shit and just do what you have to do, it's not that bad with XML document. And I think they deserve a round of applause for making an API that is not that bad for dealing with XML, because it's incredibly easy to make a terrible one.
Good. So let's say that this is limitless possibility approved.
Boop. Yes. All right. So the big topic this week is the life and death of iconoclasm. And there is going to be some big news when this podcast comes out, hopefully. If it doesn't, then I am sorry. Someone screwed up along the way. Either me or someone else I am depending on for this to actually come out on time.
You're not referring to me, right?
No. I'm not talking about...
I was like, what?
The podcast will be out on time. I am not sure if Iconoclasm's update will be out on time, which is the other thing.
Okay.
But I am hoping that by the time you hear this, everything I am saying is true. So, I'm ending my involvement with Iconoclasm, which is a project I've been doing for 6 years now. I am releasing one last version, which is the version that is maybe out when you are listening to this, with improved support for folders on iOS 7 and up, and it will be free for everyone to use, as opposed to its previous $3 price point. I am open sourcing the code so people can use it as a base for their own projects, and we'll talk more about that a little later. And people who have purchased since September can contact me until the end of the year for a refund. And I thought that we would spend the episode going through basically lessons that I've learned or how Iconoclasm came to be and all of that stuff, and then talk about basically how jailbreaking is slowly fading away, at least in my eyes, and then maybe talk a little bit about the future for Iconoclasm. Not that I'm going to be involved in it in any way.
Maybe I should keep my thoughts relating jailbreaking during this appropriate section, but it feels to me that we should have brought somebody that has a different opinion than us. Because I totally agree with you that it feels, I, as a person that also like decided to start with jailbreak and was pretty like into it, and just I kind of grew out of it. I don't want to say grew out of it, but that's the feeling I have regarding jailbreaking. It's like, during my study time, I wanted to have fun with something else regarding programming, and that was jailbreaking. But now it just feels to me that it's just too much pain. But let's continue.
Yeah. So let's go into the origins of where Iconoclasm came from, or how I got into jailbreaking, more or less. I've always been big into iOS theming, even before I owned an iOS device. So in 2007, I went to New York City for Christmas, and I bought myself an iPod Touch. But what very few people know is that, like, for the months before I owned the iPod Touch, I had been planning exactly what my home screen would look like and which icon set and which wallpaper I would use if I had an iPod Touch.
Oh my goodness, I'm not surprised.
So that when we got back to the hotel and had to deal with their terrible Wi-Fi, I was trying to jailbreak using, I think it was Jailbreak Me at the time, via the shitty hotel Wi-Fi, and it took like 5 attempts, and it took forever. And then I tried to get my themes installed, and somehow I actually, like, after several hours of messing around in the hotel room, I eventually got the theme that I had planned and everything installed on my iPod Touch, and I was satisfied for a while. And eventually, iPhone OS 2 came out, and iPhone OS 2 was special because it was the first release that was that had the public APIs for developers, and they had changed a lot of the APIs. So basically everything, almost everything that was made for jailbreak development prior to 2.0 broke. And at that point, I wrote a little Ruby script called Spring Roll, which would let you theme your icons on iPhone OS 2. And it was a terrible, terrible hack that would replace images within app bundles, which in theory is supposed to break the application from launching. But I had somehow found like a way to not make it crash while replacing that file. So for a while that worked, but people were not satisfied. Namely, it sort of broke app updates and stuff like that. And in general, iPhone OS 2 up until 2.2, the App Store was a crazy buggy mess, and you may have heard me talk about it on previous episodes, and that's why I don't use the App Store on device mostly. But now I do.
Oh my goodness. Not that again. Well, you know what? Maybe if we go on a small tangent, I'm sure your feelings regarding the on-device App Store still dates that time exactly.
Yeah. So?
But
I don't actually...
Like, what I meant by that, even if it's you're like, yeah, so it's just like, it has evolved, maybe not in a good position, but let's not touch that. But I mean, like, those bugs went away really fast.
Yeah, they went away with 2.2. And then the experience was still better to just use iTunes than to use the App Store for several years. And like 2 years ago, it became usable, more or less. And it's still bad because if you have multiple Apple IDs, the experience is terrible no matter if you use iTunes or if you use it on device. It's just using the App Store is a terrible experience no matter where you use it. These days, it is more terrible on iTunes than it is on device. So these days I use it on device, but I would rather use it in iTunes, honestly, if it worked, but it doesn't. iTunes basically doesn't work anymore at all, except to play music sometimes.
Sometimes.
But yeah, so I wrote that Spring Roll tool that let you customize icons, and very quickly Sorek came around and made Winterboard because he was like, this is madness. You can't be replacing icons in bundles. And he was right, except it worked, so I was willing to put up with it. Shortly after that, in the iOS theming world, there was a big trend for smaller icon themes. So maybe like 2/3 or half the size of the default icons. It was really trendy at that time to basically make themes that were small size icons. And when you see small size icons, you say, huh, maybe I would be able to fit more icons on screen that way. And that's when I wrote 5-column Springboard, which was a modification of Sorek's 5-icon dock tweak. To apply it to the entire home screen. And that actually was the first bit of Objective-C code I ever wrote, which is not something I would recommend to anyone trying to get into jailbreaking, but it worked. And it was a very good learning experience because I was on Linux at the time and I was trying to build iOS code on Linux, and that is not an easy task necessarily. So... 5-column Springboard was really my introduction into jailbreaking and my introduction into Objective-C and all of that stuff. And very quickly, I decided I wanted to poke around with more jailbreak stuff. And so I started a bunch of little offshoot projects, and basically none of them really went anywhere. But I had an idea when I got the name Iconoclasm, which is... people who are familiar with music games may think that it comes from the artist name for Wack and DJ Taka, a collaboration unit called Iconoclasm. That is actually not where the name came from, surprisingly enough. It came from a Toho remix by ZTS called Iconoclasm, which you can go look up on YouTube, or I'll probably put it in the show notes. But basically, I was listening to this song, and I was like, huh, Iconoclasm would be a good name for a tweak that does something with icons. And then I was like, maybe I should modify 5-column Springboard to allow for more customization. Because at the time, what people were doing is there was 5-column Springboard for columns, and you had basically dozens of different people making extensions for however many columns and however many rows, and you had to install both of them and hope that they didn't conflict with each other, and it was hell. So I wanted to fix that hell with a pro version of 5-column Springboard. And so the solution I came up with was Iconoclasm, which lets you create layout files that tell you exactly where you want your icon slots on screen to go. These are plists, if you're familiar with the format, which are basically XML files, basic XML files. There are two modes. There are grid layouts where you specify the columns and the rows you want and where you want them pixel-wise on screen. And there are freeform layouts, which is where you say, I want this many icons on screen, and this is the X and Y coordinate where I want the icon to be on screen. There's another feature, which we'll talk about in a little bit, called per-page layouts, which basically lets you set a different layout on each page, which has been immensely popular. And as I said, for the first year or so, Iconoclasm was entirely developed on a Linux installation on a Dell netbook, which is not really the development environment you would expect for someone developing on iOS, but it was incredibly valuable in learning how to build things, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
This reminds me of the good time when we are both on Linux and had so much fun trying to fix up my Wi-Fi drivers.
Yeah, fun times. Yeah,
fun times.
So Iconoclasm was an accidental runaway success. I woke up the day after launch, and I checked my sales figures, and I had made maybe about as much as some of my classmates at the time made in a year of part-time work, just in that one night. So it was a huge success from the start. And a lot of people are like, well, you made Iconoclasm, and it was a huge success, so why can't you recreate that success? And I think there are a lot of things particular to Iconoclasm that make it hard to recreate. But basically, here are the things that I found out that are basically might be causes for Iconoclasm's success. The first is phones are among the most personal of computers, and people love to customize their most personal devices. And it should be no surprise, really, because if you go check Cydia today, you will find thousands and thousands and thousands of themes, many of them being bad, but some people like to customize with bad taste. And people really jailbreak to customize their devices more than anything else, except maybe pirated apps, which is unfortunate.
No, but you're totally right. I think right now, to me, like, it would have been the only reason why I would keep jailbreaking is to customize the system. But even then, like, those customizations sometimes really broke after OS, and I was just too lazy to wait. So I customized to the normal way for the phone to work, and I was just decided to go away. And regarding those, like, customization tweaks, like, I saw recently, like, regarding this saga regarding the iPhone battery case from Apple, that Apple's kind of said or leak, or people were able to get that, like, what, 90-95% of people at least bought a case for their phone at some point?
Yeah, it was from the Samsung lawsuit that they had figures saying 2/3 of people who have iPhones have cases.
Sure, and at least like 90-95% of iPhone owners at least bought one case. So people love to be different, and even like at first, owning an iPhone was that differential factor, but now everybody has an iPhone. Sorry, Samsung and Android people. But my point being here is, like, half of the population have an iPhone, half the other half have different Androids. So if you are on the half that have iPhones, you want to be different in this part of your own world. Is you want to have your customized iPhone. And that's why I still think also that when we saw any of those like crazy like gold iPhone, real gold iPhone with real diamonds and all of that stuff, there's a market for that because people want to have unique devices. They want to be easily identified when using those devices.
Definitely. Another thing that I think benefited Iconoclasm in terms of popularity is its expansibility. So layouts are just files that sit in a folder, which means you can package them up and put them on Cydia yourself. So there is an entire category on Cydia called App Add-ons Iconoclasm that you can go to and find hundreds and hundreds of Iconoclasm layouts by other people. And if you're not particularly skilled in the creation of layouts, you can just go to that category and install other people's layouts and it'll work just fine. And what's interesting is that means that if any layout in particular or themes that use layouts to achieve a certain look or something, if one of those take off, Iconoclasm sales might take off as well. And sometimes you might have some really weird sales peaks that you aren't expecting, and that's because someone made something cool with Iconoclasm, and now people want that cool thing, so they're buying Iconoclasm to apply that cool thing. So that was interesting, and something I was not necessarily expecting. And of course, since it has its own category in Cydia, people see the category and they say, well, what's Iconoclasm? And they go look at it, and if it interests them, they'll install it. So that was also incredibly valuable, I believe.
Did you ask to have this category added to Cydia, or it grew organically, meaning that people were able to create those layouts, and then at some point, the people managing Cydia was like, oh, we need to regroup them in its own Cydia category?
So it was just a convention that packagers had at the time to make app add-ons, parentheses, the name of the thing that has the add-ons, categories, if there were like more than, let's say, 10 or 15 add-ons for a certain app. And Iconoclasm took off really fast, so the category basically came out of that. When I was working on Iconoclasm, I was thinking about how many copies I would sell total. And I was never expecting for it to take off as well as it did. I had heard some conversion rate estimates from other jailbreak developers that had free products and pro versions of their products or so. And based on 5 Comma Springboard's downloads or so, I had expected maybe 6,000 sales total. Iconoclasm has sold over 90,000 copies in 6 years, which is pretty good, especially since it's way more than 6,000. I mean, like, that 6,000, I probably sold more than 6,000 in the first month.
Sure, and I don't have the numbers for my, like, shitty tweak that I really enjoyed at the time, but I sold more than 6,000 copies, or maybe around that time, around that number. And it was just a shitty one on the CD store.
Yeah.
Like what I'm sure what you realized pretty easily is 6,000 copies was pretty fast to achieve on the CD app store, especially if you launch just before or just after a jailbreak.
Yeah. So now I'm going to talk about per-page layouts. Per-page layouts are maybe the strangest feature in Iconoclasm, I would say. Originally, I wasn't planning to have them, but then I realized that one of the other things I had implemented allowed me to implement per-page layouts fairly easily. But it's sort of a giant hack, and today I'm going to reveal the secrets of this giant hack. Because, in theory, if you're listening to this, you should be able to look at the source code now, so there's no point in hiding it.
The guy that was making a copy of Iconoclasm will be now happy.
Yeah, because now he can just copy and paste the things. But, yeah. So, iOS doesn't allow separate pages to have different column and row dimensions. So, in theory, all of the pages on the main home screen, folders are an exception, and the dock is sort of a separate thing as well, they all need to have the same amount of columns and rows. So, what Iconoclasm does when you configure per-page layouts is it says, okay, there's one column, and the amount of rows is the max amount of icons possible on any one page. Again, so far it seems pretty straightforward. Now you might say, okay, well, if there's one column, that means they all need to be lined up in a column, right? Well, no, because iOS doesn't check to see where the start of the column is. It checks what is the X and Y coordinate for each icon. So you can totally cheat and put it wherever you want. And that is how freeform layouts work in Iconoclasm in general. So basically, out of freeform layouts, I saw, oh, well, it isn't too much of a stretch to just add a bunch of empty icons at the end and then just override the things when you're inserting a new icon or moving an icon to just move it to the next page. And then you have basically exactly what per-page layouts would look like if it worked, if I could set the amount of icons on each page. So that is precisely what I did. Now, another thing that's sort of strange is, well, why would you put it all in one column? Is there a reason that you didn't just put it all in one row and multiple columns? Well, the thing is, if you were to just make each icon its own column, the issue you would have is that the system tries to load the columns from the leftmost when you are scrolling a page, and you would have icons flicker in and out depending on their position because it would be trying to load them from left to right in its own mental model. But since you're not actually limited to left or right when you're using Iconoclasm, it would just pop them in and out in the order of their state in the springboard thing. It's sort of hard to explain. But basically, they're reusing icon views to save memory, because on the original iPhone, they had very little memory. So they didn't want to load too many icon views in memory that they didn't need. So the hack is you say, okay, well, these are all in the same column, so they all need to show up at the same time. So the memory management just says, okay, well, I need to ensure that all of those icons are visible at the same time. And then your animation, when you scroll from one page to another, is flawless instead of flickering in and out.
Yeah, so in a way, you're telling it to load the leftmost column, and that's it. But in the end, what you're loading is the whole page.
Right, because there's only one column.
Yeah, and what you just said about reusing like icon quote-unquote views, it's kind of based on what they did with like table view or collection view.
Right.
Okay.
Totally. Now, the thing is, when you're doing stuff like this, which I call creative uses of SV icon list internals, you tend to break things in the system that make assumptions about how the system is going to work. And this is one of the reasons that I haven't been shipping folder layouts until this update that we're shipping now. Because the system will have weird assumptions like folders will always have less columns than the home screen, which is not necessarily true. Because you can have a freeform layout which has one column, and then the folder will have three columns, and then Springboard sort of gets confused.
So maybe before we continue, I just want to confirm something. So right now in the current non-release version of Iconoclasm, when you open a folder, it goes back to the grid layout, even if you do have a custom layout.
No, so the new version of Iconoclasm that is shipping when you're hearing this is basically allowing you to set layouts within folders, which is a feature that people have wanted for a really long time. And they can be grid or freeform. They can be however you want.
Sure, sure, like but right now it's only on the home screen and not in the folders, if we know that ship version.
Right.
Good.
So until now, basically, you haven't been able to set the layout in folders. Now, previously, I was doing it with Folder Enhancer, and the way we were doing it with Folder Enhancer is there was this class called IC Icon List View, which was a subclass of SB Icon List View that I was vending and that Folder Enhancer was taking, and that subclass exclusively got the extras layout, we were calling it, which you would set inside of Folder Enhancer folders. On iOS 7 and up, I believe, Folder Enhancer just uses native folders and tweaks the native folders instead of using my icon list view. So I need to be compatible with normal folders if I want to continue to work with Folder Enhancer. And so that's why I built that feature in, and that's why it's shipping now. Except there were a lot of those assumptions that were made by the system about this scenario will never happen, that Iconoclasm was causing it to brush up against. So one of the bugs I was having in development was, the icons for folders would just be one row of icons, but the icon would be stretched from the very top of the folder icon to the bottom of the icon. So they were huge stretched out rectangle icons instead of square icons.
Wow.
So that wasn't very nice. And luckily, a friend of the show, Lance Fetters, also known as Ashikase, who writes Folder Enhancer, had a fix for that. So he gave me the fix and I put it in Iconoclasm, and it helped me actually get the feature working, which is nice. But talking about getting features working, in 2010, I had a major burnout from Iconoclasm. And the reason for that is I had to rewrite Iconoclasm twice in the same year.
Thanks to the iPad, right?
And iOS 4. Yeah. Okay. So iOS 3.2 was jailbroken very early on. And luckily, I had an iPad then because it wasn't out in Canada yet. but I had one and I jailbroke mine and I wrote Iconoclasm for iOS 3.2. If anyone at Apple is listening, Springboard on iOS 3.2 is the best version of Springboard ever, and I would love it if you just reuse that forever and ever and ever. Thank you. Kisses. Except it doesn't matter because I'm not developing Iconoclasm anymore. But iOS 3.2, basically, SB Icon List in that version was the most perfect version of SB Icon List there ever was. It was, I'm not going to say it's bug-free because I never encountered any bugs with it, but there were probably bugs with it, but it was effectively bug-free and the API was perfect. I could not say the same for iOS 4, which basically it was incredibly buggy and the API was confusing as shit. And that was the rewrite that I did that fall for iOS 4 and was scrambling rapidly to do because I didn't have enough iOS devices. So I had to order a new iOS device just to test iOS 4 stuff on because developing jailbreak stuff when you're supporting a bunch of versions is a massive headache. And you need to have basically the walls covered with iOS devices, which is what I have right now. It's embarrassing how many iOS devices I have. But that is the cost of supporting everything back from iOS 4.3 to iOS 9 right now, which is nuts. iOS 3.2 rewrite, it was a ton of fun to do because iOS 3.2's version of Springboard was incredibly awesome, except it was thrown away basically after a couple months because once you heard that the iPad was going to get real multitasking with iOS 4, nobody wanted to stay on iOS 3.2. So the people who enjoyed that version, there were very few of them and they didn't last very long, but in my heart, it remains my favorite version of Iconoclasm ever just because it was awesome.
And this time, especially this time for iOS was kind of strange. We had 3.2 that was a branch only for the iPad. We did have 4.2, maybe 5, 6, 7, and 8 that was only for the iPhone 4, Verizon.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of, like, maybe, I don't know what happened, but it seemed that there was a lot in flux internally, and it was exposed publicly, that yeah. There was a lot of kind of branches of iOS working at the same time.
Definitely. iOS 4... 4.0 and 4.1 were massive headaches, and there are basically two reasons for that. The first of that is SB Icon List was incredibly, incredibly buggy on 4.0 and 4.1. Even in normal usage without Iconoclasm, you would get crazy bugs, and that was not fun. But then you added Iconoclasm, which screwed with the system's expectations completely, and you would get even worse bugs. So that was not fun. 4.2 magically fixed everything. And that is why I don't support 4.0 and 4.1 anymore. The other big reason is folders were introduced. And folders complexified the API significantly. And that was no fun. It was also really not fun because depending where folders were, they slid open, basically. I don't know if you guys remember this, but before iOS 7, basically, folders were inset under the wallpaper. And the wallpaper would split into two and slide out, and there would be like this drawer, hidden drawer of a folder there. And I tried for years to try and tinker with how to get the animation for that to show correctly, and I never got it to work, honestly. And like, you can go check on my desk. There is a printed out assembly dump of the animation to do the thing. I still couldn't figure it out. I have no idea how to fix that thing. Apple, you are the masters of obfuscation.
I especially remember that time. I think we were also working on some kind of a school project, and was like, "Yeah, I need your help on that." But I'm reading assembly. Like, I don't fucking care. I need your help for that.
Yeah, it was not fun. I tried basically everything, and the correct answer would have been, "Well, just don't use that animation and override it completely and present folders in a different way." The problem is that sort of overlaps with Folder Enhancer, which did that. And my recommendation for all of those years up until iOS 7 was if you want to use folders with Iconoclasm, get Folder Enhancer, because normal folders are basically impossible to work with. And that was not a good move, really. A lot of people didn't like that decision of mine, but I wasn't sure what else to do because I just couldn't crack the animation. If I could crack the animation, I would have fixed it. But I tried basically everything for years and I couldn't get it.
Can you remind the listener and I, what was the feature set of Folder Enhancer?
So Folder Enhancer, I have more experience using it on the past firmwares because I stopped using it with iOS 7, unfortunately. Sorry, Yashika, say if you're listening. But basically, it would let you use a full screen folder instead of just the little inset thing, and it would pop it over as like a window on top of the entire Springboard screen instead of just limiting you to that little drawer thing. So that was immensely useful. You could have multiple page folders, which you couldn't have at the time because that was only added in iOS 7, and naturally your folders could be however many icons you wanted, I believe. So that was fun.
So, in a way, it was iOS 7 and up folders, before iOS 7.
Yeah, except full screen instead of 3x3 on iPhone, which is sort of embarrassing these days.
Nice.
And going back to the 2010 burnout because of those two rewrites, that made me change my development strategy significantly. I tried to modularize Icon Cosmos as much as possible so that stuff could be plugged in to updated versions of iOS classes instead of rewritten. Because prior to, it's really prior to the iOS 4 rewrite more than anything else, the code was written directly inside the hooked methods from the OS. And the problem is, all of the logic lived there, and if the method signature changed or something like that, I had to copy and paste that code into the new thing and then figure out a way to make it work. That is not a very maintainable way of doing things. And it becomes an even bigger headache when you're working with a huge range of OS versions going as far back as, well, 4.3 and going all the way to 9. You don't want to have like all of these little methods with huge amount of code in them, and then you have to find the same bug in two places and patch it up. You don't want that. So instead, what I did is I basically built my own classes that most of the logic would live in, and then when a new version of the OS comes out and it has a new API for SB icon list or whatever, usually I would find a way to plug it into there or adapt it into there instead of having to copy and paste the code and adapt it manually each time, which was incredibly time consuming and incredibly hard to maintain. And the other thing I did is I decided to keep a minimal feature set. A lot of people's criticism of Iconoclasm is it basically seems as if I do no feature development on Iconoclasm, and that is correct. That is a choice. And I was talking about this because there was a competitor to Iconoclasm that launched about a year ago, I want to say, a home screen designer. And it is much more ambitious in the feature set it's trying to deliver. And the thing I told the developer at the time was, it's nice to see someone take that approach, and it may benefit you in the short term, but if something screws up significantly when Apple updates the API, you are going to be scrambling way more to recreate all of that ambitious feature set than me, who has this minimal feature set but can plug it in relatively quickly. And that's not to say I couldn't get completely screwed up by a new version update. For example, if Apple just changed their API to say, okay, well, now we're just forcing this to be a grid and we are looking for the X coordinate of the column and the Y coordinate of the row, Iconoclasm's freeform layouts and per page layouts would basically disappear immediately, because if you move to that model, I can't recreate that feature. And that's sort of always the risk with jailbreak development, is you never know when you're going to get obsoleted by a change in API. And when they're changing their API internally, they are not considering you at all. They don't care about you because they would rather you not exist.
But you no longer care about it, and that's happy.
Yeah, I don't have to care about it as much. But the thing is, yeah, I was warning this new developer who was trying to do this ambitious stuff that I hope you don't run into the same mistake that I did, where Iconoclasm had a bunch of experimental features, which I'm going to get into, that I had to all pull them, basically, because they were unmaintainable or just took up way too much time for the amount of people who were using them. And in a perfect world, I would have liked to add more features to Iconoclasm over time, except more features equals more maintenance cost, and it became less and less worth it to add those features. And unfortunately, the user sort of had to pay the price by not getting new features. So talking about those experimental features, in the 3.0 era, so this was like in the first few versions of Iconoclasm, there was a section in Iconoclasm settings called experimental features. And the idea was to be similar to Google Labs, where you would put incomplete features or features that you wanted feedback on. And there were a handful of these. The most popular one was something that eventually became More Icons by Phoenix 3200. Originally, he gave me that code and he said, you can put into Iconoclasm so that people can basically create, people who don't want to manually create layouts can just say, okay, I want this many rows, I want this many columns, and I want the padding. And just copy paste the code into Iconoclasm and we're okay and you can ship it. And ultimately it became incredibly challenging because the way More Icons does stuff is completely orthogonal to how I do stuff in Iconoclasm. And either I would have to switch completely from one mode to another in thinking, and it would just screw me up trying to fix bugs in More Icons and then switch back to Iconoclasm. It would just create weird conflicts because I was hooking similar things, but they were acting in completely different ways depending on which mode you were in. And effectively, those things should have been two different extensions completely, and that is what they are now. More Icons is actually a separate product now, and it's completely out of Iconoclasm, and I basically had to bail on it because, like, I'm sorry, this is costing way more resources than it should, and it's a feature that not that many people were using, honestly, with an Iconoclasm. There were maybe, like, 6 people who complained total when I removed that feature. And there were basically 3 or 4 of those features that I had to completely remove, and there were basically 2 or 3 people, or 6 people in the case of More Icons, people who were complaining that the feature was removed. But having to recreate these features that not many people were using and that were completely different from the rest of Iconoclasm were just not worth the trouble to keep around, unfortunately. Now time for another story from the iOS 4 days. So iOS 4 was interesting because its version of iTunes that came with it allowed you to edit the home screen in iTunes. And that was something that was incredibly worrying to me because I completely screw up the home screen. And that would be bad if I send a completely screwed up home screen to iTunes. And luckily, in the case where you add columns and rows, iTunes doesn't complain too much. It just sort of ignores the stuff past row 4 and column 4 on old devices. But if you give it too few columns and rows, then it gets very confused and it screws everything up, and that's not good. And sometimes it crashes the entire app. So I needed to find a way to block that from happening, send a sanitized home screen to iTunes so it doesn't crash, and prevent changes that you make in iTunes from actually taking place on the device. And I did this first with 5-column Springboard, and for a while what I would do is I would display a row of icons in iTunes that were fake icons that would basically say, this feature not supported with 5-column Springboard. And that was an inelegant hack, because on the very first version of that, if you actually synced your phone, then those icons would magically appear on your home screen as well, even though they don't actually exist. And the apps that they were referring to weren't on your device because they were fake apps that I made up. So that was a weird bug. But once the bugs were more or less removed, we realized as a community that this was becoming an issue, not just for me, but for anyone else tweaking folder and icon list related things. So we decided to put it off into a third-party library. So the code that was originally in 5-column Springboard and Iconoclasm basically became icon support, which is a dependency for Iconoclasm and most other icon related tweaks on Cydia today. The original version was basically my code that was converted to a third-party library by C.H. Pwn, also known as Grant Paul, and now it is currently actively being maintained by Ashikase or Lance Fetters. And that was a great move. I think it's saving everyone a bunch of trouble, and people are very quick to complain about icon support whenever their icon layouts get completely screwed up on upgrading devices, and we apologize for that. But most of the time, it's not icon support's fault. So sorry. One of the questions that I'm expecting to come up, and this is sort of like an FAQ episode thing that I'm doing, really, is why does Iconoclasm not use Theos? So first, I should explain what that means, and then I should explain to why I don't use it. Theos is a build system that is conceptually similar to the GNUSTEP build system that was developed by Dustin Howitt. Most of the time when people are talking about Theos, they aren't actually talking about Theos. They're talking about Logos, which is a subsystem available for Theos projects. And it is a preprocessor that takes syntax that resembles Objective-C class files and turns them into hooked method call. Basically turns it into calls that hook methods at runtime. And one of the big reasons that I didn't use it in Iconoclasm is Theos didn't exist when Iconoclasm started. So I got to witness the development of Theos and Logos in private IRC chat rooms because Dustin is a friend of mine. And it looked really interesting, but for a variety of reasons, I chose not to go with it. Iconoclasm originally was raw mobile substrate calls, and eventually I changed to using Ryan Petrick's Captain Hook macros. So Captain Hook is a really simple set of macros that allows you to basically do method hooking really, really easily. It doesn't look like Objective-C, but it looks like clean C code, and I really like that, and it is less trouble than having an entire preprocessor, so it's fine enough for me. And the two big reasons I didn't really switch to Theos were, A, it has never worked for me. And it's never worked for me in a theoretical sense. No, it's practically never worked for me. Every single time I go and install Theos and try to use it on a project or even just a test project, it will fail. And I don't know why it fails, but it will fail. And I feel really stupid whenever it fails because this is supposed to work out of the box, and it has worked out of the box for many, many, many people.
Including myself.
Except me. Yes, including you, but not me. It has never worked. And if you have a bad experience of it always failing out of the box, you are more likely to stick with what works than try to figure out why this thing that it was working out of the box for everyone else isn't working for you. So that is reason A. Reason B is slightly more pragmatic, which is building is crucial to my business surviving, so it's in my interest to know how it works, and if it breaks, then I can fix it myself. And that's one of the reasons that I've given Dustin a lot over the years. He's teased me for not using Theos because everybody else uses Theos, and I'm the only one, basically, who doesn't use it. The build scripts that I started with on Iconoclasm were ones that I had written myself because, again, I was building on Linux. There's not much in the way of instructions on how to build iOS shit on Linux and actually get it to work. And if you do find documentation, it's probably super, super outdated, like from iOS 1.1.4 days, and it's probably wrong now. So the build scripts I had built, I had a good enough understanding of what they were doing and how the entire build system worked that if something broke, I could probably fix it. Whereas if I imported this Theos build system, I had a general idea of how builds work outside of Theos, but I didn't know how the project was structured, where to go modify things if things were broken, and all that stuff. And it probably wasn't worth the effort of learning all that stuff in the long run. Especially since if Dustin was to get hit by a bus or something like that, then what do I do? Well, luckily, Theos has actually taken off quite a bit that I believe people are still maintaining it, even though Dustin is working at Microsoft now. But it's still a risk I wasn't going to take really early on in Theos development when I was like one of the first people to see it running. Is like, yeah, but if you go away, nobody's going to maintain this, and I don't necessarily want to maintain this when I can maintain my scripts that I already know. Which is part of why basically every big web company has their own build system, because they think the exact same thing. It's better to have your own build system that you know in and out and that is tailored specifically to what you are doing than to rely on someone else's product and then have to scramble to fix it if it doesn't work.
And you know what? It is something that I kind of never wrapped my head around regarding Theos at that time. Like, I was using it for Silent Mode Switcher, I was able to kind of understand it a bit, how to use it, but even then at that time, when I started using it, was pretty popular, and I always felt to me that if you wanted to know how it works and what's its feature set, you kind of need to know, like, deal with personally or kind of like being in the close circle. And at that time, I had bad experience with that in other open source stuff or in internships, especially when the people that designed that tool or library was always busy because he has other shit to do to make the business run.
Yeah, definitely.
So even though I was able to get it working, every time there was a Xcode version, I was like, okay, I need to fix it myself to make sure it works. And most of the time it's like, okay, I made the old version works with this kind of GCC from Xcode. And then a couple of weeks later, they got the real release.
Yeah. This was something that was said a lot about, like, third-party frameworks for developing iOS apps in the past, and I try to apply it to build systems. You generally don't want to be sitting around for a vendor to update something so that you can get working on your next update for a major iOS version. Especially in the jailbreak space, where the amount of time that has passed since the jailbreak can mean thousands and thousands of dollars. You do not want to be sitting there and waiting on a third party to update their stuff for you to be able to make money or to ship your update and then make money. And building is crucial, and you really do not want your build system to be in the hands of someone else generally.
I wouldn't say that much, but I would say that you might want to be more conservative than you used to be or used to do normally with the outside
tools.
Well,
I think specifically
with build system,
specifically
RCI
with jailbreak
tool.
Stuff, it's riskier because they are not backed by huge corporations. That, like, if you want to use Facebook's Buck build system, Facebook is probably going to continue to use that for a long time, so you are less likely to worry about it. But for Theos, the community is so much smaller, and I would say that the amount of people who are competent enough to work on that build system is much, much smaller than people would expect.
Yeah, sure, but even then, right now, like, build system optimized for iOS development, those are still rare. Like, especially, I had to, like, it's kind of part of some of my tasks that sometimes I need to help on the upgrading of the build stuff. And we can have our own solution on top of Atlassian's Bamboo system, because Xcode support in Bamboo is not that great. It is considered not supported, even if Atlassian has its own Java plugin for it. Like, and from what I heard from other friends and colleagues that use other software for build scripts and CI system, like, Apple's on its way was like, it is a niche for that need. Like, this need was never fulfilled by anybody that well. And some product might do it now. Xcode might be doing it now. But even then, for some people, there will be no perfect solution. And I think it is a recurring thing with build system and CI system.
Definitely. So now I guess we should talk about quiet in the jailbreak universe. iPhone 4 was the last device to have an exploit that was permanently baked into the hardware, meaning that it could basically always be jailbroken. However, there has been a jailbreak for every major version of iOS since then, so people have, like, this expectation that every year there will be a jailbreak for iOS, even though it is much, much less of a given than it used to be. We had it really, really easy in the early days, up until the iPhone 4, basically. You were pretty much guaranteed a jailbreak for every version. Now, that is not the case. You get one a year, maybe two if you're lucky.
Yeah, I still have a bunch of old devices, especially my 3GS, and I bought somebody else used and kind of broken iPhone 4 for that reason exactly. Because yeah. I bought my 3GS at launch day, and this one was able to be jailbroken on all version. There was a jailbreak, if I recall correctly. There was kind of problem with the, like, boot ROM or something like that. But yeah, so when you said that you added, like, a shit ton of devices and each device had its own version of iOS and its own version of certain jailbreaks, it is kind of true, and for me too, on a small scale.
Yeah. So recently, though, I want to say iOS 7-ish onwards, the sources of the jailbreaks aren't necessarily trustworthy. I don't want to necessarily blame anyone for anything, because I don't have any proof that they've done anything sketchy at all. But recently, Pangu and Taiji are the big jailbreaks that we've been seeing out of China. I don't remember the last time a jailbreak didn't come out of China, which is kind of strange. And both of these jailbreaks have been entangled with piracy-related scandals at different times, which is part of why I find them less trustworthy to begin with. And the other thing is that some of the code that they have to enable piracy, which can be disabled when installing the jailbreak, actually negatively impacts system reliability significantly. And if you're going to ship that code with your jailbreak, I'm not really trusting you that much if you're willing to let people opt in or opt out of installing code that actually makes the system less stable.
And also felt to me that there was kind of an unwritten rule that was kind of written somewhere during the beginning of the jailbreak stuff that was like, you know what, we want to do jailbreaking and we want to create tools for other user and developer, not for piracy purposes. Is we want to control our device, we want to do whatever we want, and we see the iPhone as a big opportunity to do like really, really interesting computing stuff and not to bypass the work of somebody else from the App Store. And if I recall correctly, baked into Cydia, when you wanted to add a repository that was maybe flagged as piracy or at some point did host piracy application or piracy pirated files, the Cydia application will tell you, like, are you sure you want to do that? Do you want to add that repository? Because it is kind of like a untrusted source where piracy happened in the past.
Yeah. Related to the trustworthiness of those jailbreaks, I don't know if it's directly related to them or if it's just the nature of the exploits they're using or what, but I felt that the reliability of the devices once jailbroken is much, much lower than it used to be on older devices. And it's hard to, again, blame the correct person here, because we could also say the same thing about unjailbroken iOS being a buggy piece of shit since iOS 7. So it's hard to blame. However, iOS 8 or iOS 7? One of those two, there was a Pangu jailbreak that I was incredibly angry about because it was basically unusable for 3 weeks. And they eventually fixed it, but man, those 3 weeks, I basically came incredibly close to just saying, no, there won't be an Iconoclasm update because I don't want anyone to install this shitty jailbreak on their device and basically have an unusable device. It's not worth it.
And I'm still, some days I'm still flabbergasted that people are installing shitty, like, jailbreak to make their device shittier to save money for free apps. I don't know what to think about those people, seriously.
Yeah.
It's like you invested, quote unquote, big chunk of money in an iPhone to make it work badly and then to pirate shit. Just go away.
Yeah. And on top of that, with recent years, the major reasons to jailbreak your device have sort of gone away and become a part of the operating system. And iOS 8 is really the big one for this, because now you have custom keyboards, and yes, they're limited in ways that jailbreak keyboards weren't, but they're good enough, I guess. And extensibility is also very interesting in that regard. And I think that Apple as a whole is a more open to doing more open stuff, which basically removes the need for jailbreaking, aside from, again, full system customizations that you can't do. You are never going to be able to hook other people's methods in a legit way on the App Store. Like, guaranteed, that is not going to happen. Especially not with Swift. But I think there's just so much less of a reason to jailbreak these days. And, like, myself, my interest in jailbreaking comes much more from the theoretical, it's incredibly fun to poke around with other people's apps, than a desire to actually use any jailbreak tweaks in particular. And I haven't really used Iconoclasm since 2012 myself, which is probably part of why it's sort of stagnant. Maybe if I was more passionate about Iconoclasm myself, I would put more effort into it. But seriously, since 2012, I've had like no reason really to use it because I'm satisfied with the default layout, which is not something I would have said back in 2009 when it started. And the big reason I'm really shutting down Iconoclasm is it was my only source of income for 6 years again. And all of my attempts to diversify my income sources have failed. And Iconoclasm is winding down very quickly. Like, this year I have made not a lot of money compared to previous years, to the point where, again, at the end of the year, I was going to look for a job, and luckily a job landed in my lap like a month earlier than I was expecting to look for a job, but I took it. And now I have a job. So I sort of want to get rid of everything that's on my plate right now and focus on the job so I can do the job well and then move on to something else when that job is over in April or whenever. And the anxiety that I've had over the source of income has manifested itself in many, many ways. One of them is my weight. I've gained like 20 to 25 pounds just from stress eating this year. That's not good. This year has been incredibly hard to operate as, because you have this incredible pressure to produce something, but at the same time, you can produce something that is great work, and if people don't discover it, you are not going to make any money on it. And that is sort of what I feel like I did with EOS, where I made a great gift generation app, and then nobody really cares about gift generation apps anymore unless they're free. So I was under a tremendous amount of pressure to release something good. And I think I was very proud of what I released with EOS, but it wasn't good in the right ways. So now I need to move on to the next thing. And right now I have bills to pay, and the only way I'm going to pay those bills is to do something else that is not Iconoclasm and not EOS. And that is what I'm doing. But unfortunately, that means I need to stop working on the product, especially since I don't want to work on this product anymore. I don't care about this product really much anymore. And I just want to be a normal iOS user for a while and just use the latest firmware and not jailbreak my device and just be a normie.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. And that's sort of what happened. Ending on a sad note.
Like we love to do.
It's a trademark of this podcast.
Sure, sure. But maybe if I go a bit on the reason why I stopped jailbreaking too, maybe I'll be able to end it on a good note. But yeah, I think you touched something else. All of the points, like, there's kind of no reason for me to jailbreak again. And the only one that I miss a lot is really teaming. And just by you mentioning those team where people were creating small icon version of the 4x4 and all of those customized icons for the default screen, like, I miss that, to be honest. And I know it will never come first part. There will never be a first party solution.
But yeah, right now the closest thing you have to a first party solution to that is you have apps on the App Store which lets you add custom icons by creating web clips that redirect you to our URL that launch an app. Yeah. Which is a creative hack, but is not a good experience.
Sure. Or like it can, or apps like Launch Under Pro that is like you can do that with the 6 Plus only these days, but with 3D Touch, it's like you just have multiple icons for it.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can put in the 3D Touch menu your specific icon if you want. But yeah, especially for those, like, one kind of theming hack that I really enjoy, and by the way, which is really stupid, is just to change the name of the carrier to a logo. It was stupid, but I really love to do that in the past. And yeah, the trade-off of doing theming and the work needed to do theming, just it stopped paying for itself, in my opinion. So that's why I stopped doing it.
And I feel like the theming community, the people who were really the top tier designers in the iOS and Mac community for a while were doing jailbreak themes, which is surprising. Like, people like David Lanham and Louis Mantilla, like, these are not necessarily people you would expect to have jailbroken phones, but they were making themes for jailbroken phones that were amazing and rivaled the default OS icons and stuff.
Yeah, and even some of those designers, like, I don't know about those two, but I know that some of them might have worked on iOS 1.0 apps with some of their friends and colleagues on the jailbreak land.
Yes.
Like, and the big example of that is Tap App Revenge, right?
Yeah.
Twitterific was on iOS 1 on the jailbreak store, if I recall correctly, too.
Yes, and so was Twinkle, which was also bought up by Tapulous, which did TapTap Revenge.
Yeah, so there's a lot of like big apps that was big successful app also in the App Store in the iOS 2 and 3 days that started in the jailbreak community. And all of those went away because Apple provided first-party solution to them.
Yeah, so that's about it. Well, I guess I should address sort of the idea with which I was going into open sourcing Iconoclasm, which is Iconoclasm's code as it is right now is probably, honestly, it's probably not what you want to use to continue to develop an icon-related tweak. There is stuff you can take out of there and salvage for to use as a base for a new project. But I think continuing Iconoclasm as it is right now is a bad idea, a bad decision. You are going to hurt yourself trying to use my build scripts. That's the first thing. And the second thing is the code just, it is very clear that this is code from the iOS 3 days. A lot of it has, well, I mean, the iOS 3 support part of the code is not there anymore because it was separated off into Iconoclasm Classic years ago when I wanted to drop that code so I could focus on only supporting 4 and up. And I've continued to support 4 and up since then, which is part of the insanity of the code, really. You have complete support for iOS 4 to 9 in that code, and to do that, there are certain sacrifices that have to be made to the quality of the code, really. That's unfortunate. But all of the stuff that is logic with regards to scaling layouts from one screen size to the other, all of the stuff regarding the logic for grid layouts and freeform layouts and how they should behave in their respective environments, all of that is stuff that is basically you can drop it into your own tweak if you want and just reuse the classes that I made and use that as a base for a new project. And if you want to target iOS 9 only, you can do that and it will work. And that's probably the same thing to do, really. If you want to create a new thing that is compatible with Iconoclasm layouts, that is a smarter decision than saying, I'm going to continue developing Iconoclasm.
Good. And also, if you have questions about the code base, you should send an email to Yannick. No, kidding. Kidding. But yeah, and that joke is regarding to my last question is, how do you plan to like clearly communicate that this code is just for like maybe historical reason that you've decided to put it open source and not to have help from others?
Well, the first thing is I'm going to link to this podcast.
That's nice. Well,
among other things. So yeah, I'm going to put up a big post that explains basically the basics of what's going on, that I'm stopping development on Iconoclasm, that I'm open sourcing it and all that stuff. I'm going to detail in human readable language the license under which I'm releasing it, which is looking to be something similar to a BSE license right now. I haven't completely finalized that. But basically the thing is, you can use this code to do basically whatever you want. I would appreciate it if you do not use the name Iconoclasm, because that would cause confusion amongst users. I would prefer it if people used a different name and used language like compatible with Iconoclasm layouts, because I think that that is clearer about what's going on than if someone just makes Iconoclasm 2 and then people can be confused as to whether I am involved with the project or not. So technically, as far as I know, the license does not actually prohibit anyone from releasing an Iconoclasm 2, and someone with a bad intention could certainly do that. But I would hope that the community would do the right thing and not do that. And the other thing is you basically can't use my name to endorse your side project unless I actually endorse it. Because I don't want to be involved with the endorsement of an Iconoclasm spinoff project that I don't actually know or haven't used. Or basically, if I endorse it, I endorse it. If not, please keep my name off of your project unless you are attributing that I basically, unless it's in the license that says you took code from me, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that would be the bare minimum to say that at least you have a license that says this code, part of this code came from the Icon Cloud, some project
and
from
Yannick. I honestly don't care if people use it commercially or for free projects. It's out there. Use it if you want. If you don't, that's fine. I just want to make it better for the community because there is such a huge category of iconoclasm layouts out there. And sure, some of them are dated and go back to the very first iPhone screen size. But those are still usable. And it's not because I want to stop working on this code base that all of those plists have to go to waste. And people can just reuse the exact same classes I was using and add compatibility to their existing icon tweaks if they want, and basically just migrate a bunch of iconoclasm users over to their thing if they want. I don't care. That's fine.
Also, regarding the open sourcing of iconoclasm, before taking that decision, have you looked at maybe selling or maybe changing the ownership of that code base to somebody else?
I have had an offer in the past, but that was a long time in the past. But I'm not really interested in that.
Good.
That's all I really have to say.
No, sure. And I kind of knew that answer, but I wanted to make it clear.
Yeah.
Good. So that's it for your topic?
Yep.
Good. So yet again, another great topic. Hopefully it will be the last topic where you say that you're like ending support from something else. And hopefully in the future you have like great and long successful project like this one. To be honest though, this one was like 6 years old and it was pretty successful, but hopefully like you had too much kind of weird project these days, so hopefully future will be brighter.
Yep.
Good. So if you want to find the show notes for this week's episode, you can go on the Limitless Possibility website, and that's limitlesspossibility.net/30. Yes, that's episode 30 this week. So you can find it at /30. Also, you can find the other episode and the podcast on the web at limitlesspossibility.net and also on Twitter at @limipo_podcast. That's LIMIPO_podcast. You can find myself on Twitter at @lucconouche, LUCCONOUCHE. And you can find Yannick at
Sakurina, SAKURINA.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.